Welcome to Breeders Syndicate, where we explore the history of a clandestine scene through the eyes of the folks who lived it. I'm Matthew, owner of Riot Seeds. I'll occasionally be joined by my co-host Not-So-Dog, breeder and grower from Mendocino. Welcome to the underground.
That's a shagagag, dude.
Perfect script from up north, or cut upon it.
All right, how's everyone doing? Welcome to Breeder Syndicate. I'm Matthew. This is my buddy, Not-So.
Evening.
Today, I think we're going to talk about some cups, and we're not talking about the kind that protect your genitals. We are talking about the kinds that come with awards for prestigious accomplishments in cannabis. First off, one of my homies, Gray Skull, hit me up and asked me if I could let everyone know that a fellow outlaw grower has gone down. They're trying to raise some money for Emerald Delta over on what is it called? GoFundMe. So if you can, we're going to have a link kind of floating up in the description as we're going, like on the bottom. Go check it out. Type it in the description. All that yada yada yada. Go help a friend out. It was all weed charges, and it's like $160,000 bail in Tennessee. So fuck the police. Anyway, so let's continue. So cups and events. Recently, a big event has happened called the Ganjir event or Cowboy Cup, I want to say.
Cup, yeah.
Yeah, you've seen it out and about on the old Instagrams and the other social medias. It's been popping up a bunch. People have been wanting to talk about it. So I wanted to put up a quick explanation kind of from Ganjir. I think that is the best one to do. I believe it's on this window. Let's see. Yeah. Can you see it?
Yep.
All right. So this is a quick explanation from Ganjir of what happened. And I won't read the whole thing, but I'll scroll through it. It said, last weekend, 12 certified Ganjirs were chosen to judge at the 2022 Cowboy Cup in Stillwater, Oklahoma. The judges were selected by both Ganjir team and organizers of the Cowboy Cup based on experience, field of expertise, and ensure diverse viewpoints were represented. So basically, they chose a bunch of judges. They go into detail about how judges were chosen, whatever, and people were allowed to submit samples. And they had to have COAs with their samples, certificate of authenticity, basically saying that there's no mold, no residual chemicals from growth, whatever, no junk in your shit, right? So they had to submit paperwork with each sample. Well, at the cup, I guess they had microscopes, like they show right here, sitting there to analyze each sample. And here are the results. I guess, despite the COA, they wanted to review each sample there under the microscope, which I think is actually good. I think that's a great safeguard because you never know what kind of authenticity these labs really bring to the table. So
and you can also see trichome development and stuff too.
Exactly. You know, I mean, you get a much better view of the bud, obviously, and people that understand buds can get an actual good look at it, what's going on there. So the samples, it says, unfortunately, results were not great. Of the 12 samples in the sun-grown category, 10 were found to consistently show both visual and aromatic indications of contamination. So that means 10 smelled like mold. Or whatever, presence of something, some kind of scent. Of the 8 samples in the light assist category, 7 were found to consistently show both visual and aromatic indications of contamination. Not good. Of the 20 samples in the indo category, 2 were found to consistently show both visual and aromatic indications of contamination. This means that contamination was clearly visible in 19 of the 40 samples submitted to us for assessment. And here's some pictures so you guys can get an idea. Ladies and gents, I'm sorry, I always say guys. Ladies and gents can get an idea for some of the contamination in there. It said, because the levels of contamination were both clear and evident to the certified Ganjirs, the samples were disqualified from the competition. Each disqualified sample was photo documented for proof of the contamination. So, yeah. Not good. Not looking good for the Oklahoma entrance. Okay, so I got to remove this thing. There we go. So not looking good for the Oklahoma entrance. There are a lot of people really, hyper super pissed off that thought that there was some rigging going on, that maybe these people were trying to sell them, I guess, during a speech or some kind of post that one of the people from Gonjir made. It offered them some training in being able to spot contamination and mold and maybe how to grow different. And this upset a lot of people because they're like, we're growers. We know our stuff. We had COAs. You had a little scope with the, you know, stuff like that. So that's kind of how it was taken. And it's really interesting to watch how it turns out in the community.
Yeah, I mean, I will say, I do think it's a little, just to start, I think it's a little silly that in California, in the West Coast, at least, I would say that when people are going for awards and things like that, they, you know, they make sure that what they're submitting is hopefully not going to do that, right? Yeah. Not just grabbing random handfuls. If you can find 19 out of 40, that's basically 50%.
Yeah.
If you can find visible enough mold that all the judges agree it needs to go, then, you know, there wasn't a very good quality control for a lot of the entrants, put it that way.
Yeah. So that's where we know we're at with the situation now. But we kind of wanted to talk about how we got to this situation, the points of harvest cups and how they kind of originated, and on to the Amsterdam cannabis cups, and on into, you know, other sorts of quasi harvest cups that maybe started more traditional and legit, that became more corporate, and on to where we're at with a lot of these, you know, extract throwdowns. But to start, I mean, Natso, who knows better about the early cannabis cups than my boy Natso? So let's jump into this.
I think there's probably two kinds you could say of cups. There was, like you mentioned, there was a lot of informal cups, which are essentially friends gathering to share weed, right?
Yeah.
And then there's like cups that are advertised and more famous, and like the you know, like the High Times cannabis cups, and the, you know, the Emerald Cup, and a lot of the different, you know, hashish competitions or different things that have happened where it's a little bit more public. And as a result of that, there's usually money and rep involved. So it brings a different, it brings a different flavor to it, I think.
Always.
And, you know, these days, as evidenced by some cowboy cup in Oklahoma, cups are just events that anyone can hold. And as a result, there's hundreds of cups across America now, probably, yeah, when it comes down to it. But in, back in the day, as far as like ones that got advertised, there was pretty much one.
Yeah.
There was the High Times Cannabis Cup held in Amsterdam, you know?
Yeah.
And that cup had a major impact. Probably it's, you know, the most impactful one, because that was a real nice issue of High Times.
Yeah.
And the Cannabis Cup winners would have, like, there'd be pages of really high quality gloss, you know, for, you know, nice pictures, write-ups, the whole bit. And I think it kind of drove seed sales and desirability, especially in the 90s.
Yeah.
It was a big deal to win cups. Don't you agree?
Yeah. I mean, seed sales were kind of dependent on that, on these cups that were going on. And most of the people that were entering those first cannabis cups were dealing in seed sales.
I mean, most people's first images that they ever saw of any kind of AK-47 or Big Bud or White Widow, or, you know, a lot, you can name a lot of different strains where, like, probably the first time you ever saw it was pictures in High Times in the cannabis cup.
Well, I mean, the cannabis cup's so prestigious in a lot of people's minds, like at least in the general public's, that when a lot of us get into growing, when we first go to buy our first pack of seeds, the one thing we think about, has it won a High Times cannabis cup? Because most of us know, even with basic smoking knowledge, when you jump into this, that there is a magazine called High Times and that they have an event called the Cannabis Cup and that there are winners of these things, you know?
Yeah.
So I think that's a lot of people's first entrance is who has won the cannabis cups when they get into growing.
And it was kind of one of those things too, where Amsterdam at the time was one of the few places in the world where you could gather openly with a weed festival.
Yeah.
So it brought together a bunch of heads from all over the place.
Yeah, it did.
You know? And there was some weird stuff about it too. There was people that thought that people that went there were watched. They were worried about a bunch of gathering of growers and seed makers and hustlers and stuff because, you know, it was heavily under prohibition at the time. And there was big agencies in Europe and America, like wanting to know what was going on. Mm-hmm. So there's even a bunch of drama about the cup has always had some weird politics.
Yeah.
But from a cannabis perspective, and certainly from like a younger smoker's perspective, it's safe to say that a lot of people would get that issue of High Times and drool over the multi-page photo shoot.
Yeah.
Of the winners and the entries and you know, and all that type of stuff. And so, some of the late 80s stuff, you know, it's so old now that it's reference points for some of those early strains and photos of those early strains.
I don't think we've mentioned it yet. The first cup was held in 1988, correct?
I put 87 these up on the or 88. I think it might have been 87.
I think so too, because the first High Times 87 one was Skunk One, but it lists it here as 88. But I want to say on the front cover of High Times, it was the red issue, and I want to say it was 87, but I might be wrong. Yeah. And I think we learned something recently here about the second cup winner, which is the Early Pearl Skunk One on Lights Five Haze, right?
We did. I mean, that one's gone through a metamorphosis. So when that got released, it won the 89 Cannabis Cup overall, right? Yeah. And that's what Neville sold it at, and that's what he entered it at. Yeah. But then a couple of years later, he changed the name to Silver Pearl by Haze.
Yeah.
Right? But it was the same mix. He listed the mix. He just changed the name. So you could still read exactly what it was.
Yeah.
And then when Sensi bought out his company, they just changed it to Silver Haze.
Yes.
And they took away most of the information of what was in the hybrid itself. It was just a name and a vague description, but they mentioned that it won the 89 cup.
Yeah.
And Neville helpfully laid out what the mix was. So I can't even remember how it was written. Is it like EP by Skunk One by NL5 by Haze?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's not a very great marketing name.
No, it's not the best. It's not the best marketing name at all.
No. So Neville got rid of that and called it, you know, and called that strain Silver Pearl.
Let's see. I'm going to remove this thing so we can see it. I don't know if you can see the screen here. It might be too tiny for you to see, huh?
It's too tiny for me to see, but you can walk me through it.
Okay. Third cup. We got Northern Lights 5 from the Seed Bank. Classic.
So, maybe I'll throw in a little tidbit about that too. There are several pictures from various people that Matt and I have gathered of living flowering plants well close to harvest and dried flower of that exact famous NL5 cut.
Yeah.
And so without, you know, because it won, it got the full photo spread. And it got some pictures and it gave us a reference point 35 years later or whatever for what that exactly looked like.
But there's more to the story, like even more, because if that Neville's, if that NL5 that won the cup wasn't the same NL5 that was shipped over in that little
terrarium
type situation, then referencing the Seattle NL5 seed line to that specific cut would be a little confusing.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where Matt and I, you think you have something like that figured out and nuance comes in. I'm not even exactly sure what to say to that one, but this, that different people have different perspectives and remember things, you know, and even today, like history is gets altered, perhaps is the best way to put it.
It can be fluid.
It can be fluid. It can be fluid. Well, you know, you think you understand something and then something comes along that kind of flips that on its head. And so Matt and I recently got some credence that, like, maybe, you know, we had heard a long time ago that one of the NLs might have been NL Steve Murphy's Afghan mixed with a Neville Afghan.
Yeah.
And And Seattle Greg, in a post a long time ago, even sort of confirmed it. But then all the other evidence came out against it, and it kind of dropped, and we never heard it again. Well, recently we heard that that was probably true.
Yeah. That it's a it's a decent, reliable source that would know.
It's definitely a close-in and reliable source. So, it's kind of a lot of this old oral history, you have to lean into what you believe. But what Matt was referencing is that we believe that there was two famous NL5 cuts. There was one that was a little bit more sativa that was passed around the Pacific Northwest and Seattle Greg's crew. And there was one that Neville found out of NL5 labeled seed.
Yeah.
That Greg sent him, that he thought was a total Afghan throwback and exhibited no sativa influence that he could discern whatsoever.
Yeah.
And supposedly this one mother cut became the winner of all that, and went on to become famous and got bred to all kinds of things.
Supposedly, I think the story is that he crossed that to that NL5 cut to either Afghani one or that Mazar, you know, and then that something was selected from that, and that became the NL5 cut that won the cup.
Indeed.
Yeah. So that's something to clarify. Like, if we ever misspeak on anything and we get, you know, any future info, we'll always update it as best we can without throwing anyone under the bus or doing anything crazy. But we like to make sure that we get everything as accurate as possible, no matter what, even if it is us being wrong at one point. It's important.
So what one next?
So we are at, let's see here. We are at a skunk from Free City. So I assume it's like a skunk one, maybe. I don't know who Free City is.
No, nope, I don't either.
Then we have Haze Skunk One from Homegrown Fantasies, or Homegrown Fantasy, which became Homegrown Fantasy.
Fantasies later, yeah.
And then it says High Times Cannabis Cup winner Master Kush. I don't know why it says that beside it. Hindu Kush crossed the Skunk One. Which
I wonder if that was Pot of Gold. I do. I wonder if that got named. What did it say again?
It says Hey Skunk One from Homegrown Fantasy. Then in parentheses, it says High Times Cannabis Cup winner Master Kush equals Hindu Kush X Skunk One. But then below it, it says Hayes, the 1993 is Hayes Northern Lights 5 from Cincy Seed Bank. And then it says the same thing next to that. High Times Cannabis Cup winner Master Kush equals Hindu Kush Crust of Skunk One. So I don't know why they're putting.
All right, that's confusing. Let's move on.
So yeah, once you get to 30 or 94, you get to Jack Herer. That's 95. They're wrong, right? No, White Widow's 95.
No, so I went to that cup when I was
Which cup was it? The 94 cup for Jack Herer?
Yes. Okay. The one right. because what they did is that cup that was one of the first times I went out to get seeds. I'd gone that summer previously, but I went back in fall. And they wanted to dedicate the whole theme of the Cannabis Cup was around Jack Herer and his contributions to cannabis.
Yeah.
Right. They had speeches by various people and all kinds of stuff.
They had special limited edition posters too. I still have a few. Yeah. One of them, so one of them I promised to Pacalolo. I promised one away already. So.
They really tried to ramp up marketing then, right? And so they wanted to release something that was named after him for that cup. And Neville had been working on this NL5 Haze by Skunk Haze project, but he didn't really feel like it was ready.
Yeah.
But the Dronkers convinced him to release it. And they released it at the cup. And it was called Jack Herer after the theme of the cup.
Yeah.
And then Neville kept working that line, and 3 or 4 years later, he re-released it, improved as he thought, as Super Silver Haze.
Yeah.
I was at that cup. One thing I'll say about these cups is, from a personal level, right? Mm-hmm. I went to like 3 of them, and it was definitely my least favorite time of being in Amsterdam. It was usually in late November, and Amsterdam's cold that time of year, right? So yeah. It could be sleeting or icy rain or it's freezing, and then you're in these coffee shops and like, and they're super crowded, and most of the best weed is being hoarded for all of the dignitaries and like famous people and various folks coming in to smoke weed for the cannabis cup.
Yeah.
So for a normal person, it was like crowded, cold, and it was harder to find good weed.
Yeah.
But it was still cool to see. And they did, just like at, they did, we were just describing, they did usually drop big name seed drops at the cup itself.
Yeah.
Because it got a lot of free press.
Yeah.
And everybody was there, you know.
I did find recently in an old article, it was the year Bubblegum won the Cannabis Cup. And it was in an old article in High Times. They were interviewing Tony from Sager Matha, and he was the one who entered it in for the gray area, and it was actually Bubbleberry that he entered in as Bubblegum. So yeah. I saw that, and I was like, what? I didn't even know that. So apparently sometimes what is entered in and named isn't necessarily what it is. We need to
clarify yeah, that as well. That should be clarified too. I mean, people, you know, there's Neville would say that, you know, the same cut that he had of, you know, of NL5 Skunk Haze got like four or five different names.
Yeah.
And we've seen that out west a bunch too, fast forward a bunch of years. But what happened, I think, is by the early to mid 90s, the Cannabis Cup became a big vehicle for selling seeds.
Yeah.
And so Matt was about to talk about, what is it, 95, like the year after it's when White Widow won?
Yeah. So it looks like by 1995, Greenhouse Seeds started smashing the butthole out of the Cannabis Cup. We have 95 White Widow, 96.
Lovely.
White Russian.
Yep. 97 was Peacemaker.
Yep. We got 98 SSH, Super Silver Haze, 99. We got Super Silver Haze again.
Three times,
And then 2000, all of a sudden something weird happens and we have Blueberry winning a cup, as it should always win every cup, and don't you forget it. But that was a departure from the normal, right?
So what should be mentioned is that at the time, White Widow, White Rhino, Peacemaker, which is a Great White Shark, and Super Silver Haze all came out of the same shop.
Yeah.
It was all out of Greenhouse. The White family was stuff getting released by Shanti Baba, and the Haze was stuff getting released by Neville.
Yeah.
So Greenhouse, I think they placed top for 5-6 years in a row.
Yeah. It got pretty ridiculous.
You know, and for different things too.
Yeah.
There
were lots of accusations during that time of purchased cups and whatnot, and of course there were heavy arguments that it was only done on merit during those years. I mean, and to be real, they had some of the most accomplished breeders in history working for them at the time, so they didn't necessarily have to buy cups to win. Most of the people around them were using F2s or, you know, different filial generations or hybrids thereof, the work established by the people who are winning the cups. So by that point, I don't know that it was necessarily something we can go, aha, it was already corrupt. It was
with the White family, that's the sort of the proof is in the pudding, in the sense that it started winning the cups in the mid 90s, and it was one of the most common breeding tools for the next decade.
Yeah.
The amount of people that bred with White Widow or White Rhino or Great White Shark or any of those White family things. I mean, I think that, you know, I've mentioned before that, like, when I first went to like some of Ron's harvest parties and stuff, things by White Widow were one of the most common things you would find.
Yeah.
It just became a huge family. So in that regard, and Super Silver Haze did the same thing. So I do think there was politics, but I think there was a crew there that had significantly better weed.
Yeah, I would agree.
And they just sort of, and honestly, Neville, you know, I mean, Shanti came in with the White family late, but Neville pretty much dominated the 90s.
Yeah.
To a large degree.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, everything except 88 with Skunk One and 91 up until the White Widow in 95 was Neville. Everything else was Neville.
So it was like Neville had this big run, and then Neville and Shanti joined forces, and then the stuff they released together under Greenhouse had a big run. And I also think too that, like, I mean, because it did for me. You know, you'd go to Holland and you try to buy those seats.
Yeah. So after the year that Blueberry won the cup, we have a new entrant for the King of the Crown, which is Derry from Barney's Farm with Sweet Tooth. You remember the Sweet Tooth?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's some Breeder Steve work.
Yeah. The Sweet Tooth. It was a Blueberry Sweet Pink Grapefruit, if I remember correctly. No. Yeah.
And you know, there was a Pheno Sweet Tooth 3. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of seed, there was a lot of people. I would say in that era, probably the three or four most common breeders as far as like new school was, like, there was the White family from Shanti. There was the Blue family from DJ. There was stuff from Spice of Life, which is, we were just talking about. There was a lot of work being put out right then by Breeder Steve.
Mm-hmm.
You know, his Louis, Legends Ultimate Indica, his Blockhead, his Sweet Tooth. And probably even the first edition of Brothers Grimm was right around that era too.
I want to give props to the real breeder of Legends Ultimate Indica, and that's my boy Red.
Red,
and
yeah.
If you want to check out Red, we have an interview with him and Chimera ways back. A few of them. It was.
Great. I mean, there's always been a difference. Sometimes the person that releases the seed line is the actual breeder.
Yeah, of course.
But many times they're the aggregator.
Yeah.
And they're the person that was willing to take seeds from someone else and go public with them in some fashion.
Yeah.
You know, and a lot of breeders are a mix of the two. They made some things themselves and they got some things from other people and, you know, and they went that route. But I would say that, it became one of the biggest drivers of sales of seeds and popularity. It was like kind of an event thing. Even if you didn't buy High Times every month, if you were a stoner, you probably bought the High Times Cannabis Cup issue.
Yeah.
I would say in that era.
And there, during this time when Blueberry started winning, because for 2 years it was Blueberry stuff that won, there was some alleged people getting caught and banned from participating in the cup for a few years after Shanti and Neville disappeared. Maybe our young, our little buddy, this guy.
So, yeah, I mean, they, that's kind of an interesting story in the sense that Greenhouse Seeds was a partnership between Neville, Shanti, and Arjun, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it was several very cool coffee shops to visit in Amsterdam, you know, and they sold some of the best flower in the spot, and they were the exclusive spot to get Neville and Shanti work after Neville left Sensi.
Yeah.
So for 5 or 6 years there, they kind of ruled the roost. And I think eventually Shanti and Neville chafed under sort of being like the back end, but still had to be in the shadows a bit while Arjun was the face. And they decided to break off and do their own thing. Shanti first and then Neville a year later. And after Neville's experiences at Sensi, when he partnered at Greenhouse, he did not let any seeds or breeding stock or anything like that be controlled by Greenhouse. They kept that in house themselves. Yeah. So they provided Greenhouse with a bunch of flower and a bunch of seeds to sell. Well, when they left, that left Greenhouse a real issue because it was the biggest seed bank at the, you know, seed company at the time. It had been winning awards for 5 or 6 years in a row. It had all these unique lines. It was crushing the competition. And all of a sudden it didn't have any breeding stock or any in-house breeders.
Yeah.
And I believe that's when Franco got hired.
Yeah, I have no idea when Franco came in. That was,
I believe he came in after Neville and Shanti left.
Yeah, he wouldn't have been there when they were there.
No. And he worked for greenhouse, and they ended up using a bunch of greenhouse seed that they had to do pheno hunts, and they started making a bunch of Argens Haze 1, Argens Haze, Super Lemon Haze, all these different things.
Yeah.
But we believe that they actually got banned from competition for a year for trying to tilt the scales in their favor.
I think it was a few years ban, actually.
It might have been a few. It was at least one.
Yeah, at least one.
At least one. But it went to show that what he really wanted, obviously, was he really wanted to win some cups after his stars left.
Yeah.
It was a big financial thing, you know?
So from 2001 to frickin' 2000, I'm trying to watch my language, so frickin' 2012, it is a head-to-head show, and this is a long time, between Barney's, Dairy at Barney's, and Greenhouse. And we are basically having Cannabis Cup winners with Morning Glory, whatever the hell that is, a Hawaiian Snow, which was whatever they were selling that month as Hawaiian Snow. We have Amnesia Haze, we're all familiar with that. We have Willie Nelson, not made by Dairy from Barney's Farm. Ardron's Ultra Haze, number one. God knows. We have G13 Haze, I believe, from who made that? Soma. Was Neville too? Neville originally, maybe?
Yeah.
That? Yeah.
But I think he gave it, I think he gave some to Soma. And Soma used it. So someone did, yes.
Yeah.
But I think that goes to show right there that there was probably a 15-year, 18-year period where the Cannabis Cups and High Times in Holland were the epicenter.
Yeah.
And then the epicenter shifts.
Yeah.
And you're talking right around that time. You're talking early 2000s, right?
Yep. 2001 to 2012.
Well, now we start getting some of the early Emerald Cups in California. Mm-hmm. Now we start getting some more activity. The forums and things had changed things a whole bunch. So people were communicating in different ways. You could buy and trade seeds on the internet. And Amsterdam started not becoming the primary destination that people flew to get seed.
Yeah.
You could get it from Canada. You could get it from local different folks. You could get it from, you know, DMing people on Overgrow or Cannabis World or IC Mag, right?
Yeah.
I mean, when you were first coming out, like who was big on the forum selling seed?
Oh God. Who was big on the forum selling seed? Vic High. It was the end of the Vic High era. That everything was like Space Queen, Widow, mm-hmm. something. Yeah, JoJo was big. Dutch Flowers had just started or ended. Who else is big during that time? Brothers Grimm had already ended. Oh, Spice Brothers. Who else? Yeah. Who was that other dude? It was another guy that did all like Brothers Grimm repros. I can't remember off the top of my head, but yeah, he did a bunch of Apollo 11 stuff like that. Was real big. And TGA had just started making their name,
right? So, and those are all for the most part they're not Holland based situations.
Exactly. Right? About that time, Joey Weed. Thank you. I think about that time I had been hipped to the whole market by about 2007, 2008. I had already been hip to the whole fact that the market had been moved, that everything that the Dutch were selling was probably made in Spain and not exactly what they would have been selling, say, even 10 years prior, you know?
Well, it's fair. It's also fair to mention that in 1999 or so, maybe it was 2000, they changed the laws in the Netherlands, where before you were allowed to legally grow cannabis to make seed. Then they changed it and they closed that loophole. And around that time, a lot of the traditional seed companies in Holland got raided.
Yeah.
And genetics were lost. And no, everyone's been very tight-lipped about that era. But we know Sensi got visited. We know Sirius Seeds got visited. We know Tony from Sag Martha got busted so bad he shut down for 15 years.
Yep.
It kind of rolled through. So some nuance of all that stuff moving to Spain or Switzerland is all of a sudden Holland became unfriendly.
Yeah.
And sadly, people lost some stock, some mother stock and some father stock. And, you know, and things got mixed up, and there was great financial pressure to not admit what you'd lost.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, it's kind of like we kind of trust Sensi in the 90s and in increasingly not as the 2000s went on. Right.
As Neville had less to do with Greenhouse and Sensi, I think a lot changed, and it became very obvious. And it was mostly because, I mean, there's only so many people that really take everything so serious when it comes to genetics and being that anal about getting everything right the way it's supposed to be. There's only a few that have ever existed, in my opinion.
So then you could probably say that sometime in the early 2000s, the High Times Cannabis Cup, after sort of like a 15-year run of dominance, really started losing pizzazz and like the capturing the imagination of stoners.
Yeah.
It changed. And you know, we, you know, 215 and Colorado, and you know, there was different things that were going on in America at the time where things were starting to loosen and open up more and more. So the epicenter of interest shifted.
Yeah.
I want to say the first Emerald Cup was probably in the early 2003 or four.
Let's see. Emerald Cup.
If I had to guess, I would say within a year or two of that, and it started at Area 101 in Mendo. Which is a little ways north of Laytonville. That's a property Tim Blake owns, and he threw events there for a long time. I can't remember exactly when it grew, but that's kind of like what shifted is cups sort of went through a lull of not being all that important.
Yeah.
And then I think they probably had a resurgence when the West Coast medical cups started growing in popularity.
Yeah.
The Emerald Cup, when the Emerald Cup especially got bigger, High Times started throwing, instead of having one cup a year, they started having how many, Matt?
Oh my God. Well, at first they were doing like a High Times Cup California, and then they would do High Times California. And I remember the first year Denver had it, and then it became like High Times. You'd have California once or twice a year, it'd be California. Once or twice a year, it'd be Denver. And then you'd also start adding in Michigan. And then it became like three times each, you know, each state, each year. And then it just became a shit show of, you know, however many a year. I couldn't even keep count anymore.
Well, that thing dramatically changed it from like going from sort of like a once a year event.
Yeah.
Right. That was fairly short, to turning it into sort of like a circuit.
Yeah.
Right. It was a circuit. And so that being that it was a circuit, it morphed from, instead of it just being sort of like a collection of people gathering and a competition,
yeah,
it grew this little economy all around it as well. So a lot of these cups, it would be a gray area in these states where you could go and you could see a bunch of growers flower and you could buy directly from small breeders, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so it became a way for industry people to see each other.
Yeah.
And to that, meet the public.
That was for sure. That really was what it became to be. And it for a while, I think it was pretty special. And I think a lot of people thought it was pretty special. Like not just on the business level, like a lot of us would make most of our money for the year at Emerald Cup. But on a level where you get to see a lot of the people that you grew up looking up to in this business. And a lot of times you'd get to have dinner with them and you'd end up finding a peer as opposed to someone you just look up to. It was a wild time. It was definitely different.
So then it became multi-layered in the sense that you could kind of turn some of those events into what you wanted them to be. If you were super into the competition, you could stay in those areas and focus on that.
Yeah.
You know, if you wanted to stay in the area where you were going to meet a bunch of breeders and growers and industry types and various people that would gather, you could just kind of use it to rub shoulders and network and chat and see people in person.
Yeah.
It's where a lot of clandestine people decided to start showing their faces.
Yeah, that's true too. Very you know, much so.
It's where you could go and decide, I'm going to punch Matt Riott.
Yeah. Yeah. That is a popular choice too.
Yeah, I'm going to go to Emerald Cup and I'm going to punch Matt Riott in the face.
One thing I don't want to forget is for some of the old timers, the nugs and jugs, stuff like that. If you want to talk about some of that real quick. Did we cover it?
No, we haven't. We haven't mentioned it at all. We kind of, honestly, we just started talking about like the lack of of cultural impact that the cannabis cups from High Times had hit by the early 2000s.
Yeah.
And then we just started riffing on their replacements, but we really didn't go into depth beyond that.
Okay. Let's hit Nugs and Jugs. Cause I think that's one of those special small events that not a lot of people know about that existed.
Well, why don't you chat on it for a minute?
I wasn't around for that. That's Nugs way before and Jugs. My time. Yeah. You go ahead.
I mean, some of them we've almost done like halfway whole episodes on. We, you know, like Ron's.
Yeah.
You know, those would be considered like harvest parties or whatever. But there was a lot, you know, separate from like the Emerald Cups and the stuff that was so blatant. There's invite only cups.
Yeah.
You know, there was invite only gatherings that had no cup. It was just a way for, you know, dozens of characters from our world to safely meet up and swap stories and seeds and plants and clones and weed, you know. Yeah. It was where a lot of like little people's private interests started blending. And it was an era too before anyone was worried about personal rep, because that was so fleeting and it was still dangerous. So
yeah,
it was the kind of thing where I'd go to a harvest festival and this dude would give me, you know, 100 seeds of Blue Widow by Sweet Tooth 3. And this person would give me 50. People were just excited that you wanted to take seeds of their work, you know?
Yep.
So there was a lot of trading that went on amongst amateurs and enthusiasts and stuff like that. But they were all the stuff we mentioned before. There was a new wave of breeders that had followings.
Yeah.
You know, people were all excited about Breeder Steve and you know, Brothers Grimm and, you know, DJ Short with all the blueberry stuff right then was exploding. And, you know, all the white stuff was popular because it added frost and density to almost anything you added it to. And so, you know, and there was people going over to Switzerland and seeing Breeder Steve or seeing Shanti. So nothing like a little in-person chat to make a fan base, right?
Yeah.
Because that's what some of the cups became too, right? It was you could go and meet your breeder and talk to them in person.
Yeah.
And there would be lines. I mean, you remember, this is kind of late in the Emerald Cup, but our buddy Bodhi was famous for not being there.
Yeah, yeah. Being there and not being there.
Yeah. And the first year that he had an actual booth, I mean, there was like a 75-yard line for a day and a half.
Yeah. Do you remember what he was doing that day? Like the first time he showed up, he was like getting in costumes and getting in his own line and like standing next to people and like talking to them about his own stuff. And they didn't even know they were talking to him. And then he'd like walk up and sell them seeds real fast and they'd freak out. Yeah,
he would. And he,
yeah, I don't know if that was clever.
I don't know if it was that year or the next year, but he got a hold of this enormous stack of original 1985 Neville seed bank catalogs.
Yeah. That came from Clyde.
And it came from Clyde.
Yeah, yeah.
I just remember he walked around. He had this big pack, you know, this big side bag, and he just every good friend got a couple of copies of Neville's first catalog that he put.
Santa Claus did. It was amazing.
Yeah, Santa Claus did, and probably some like weird tobacco seeds and some crazy Indian sativas that he had gathered or whatever.
Perfumes. There was perfumes. Yeah.
So that's just the kind of neat thing that you can do, because it was like, It's almost weird in the sense that all day long, you know, customers and fans get to hang out and get to go meet the people and ask questions and buy seeds direct from that person and know you're not getting scammed.
Yeah.
And then after all that, in between all that at night, like a bunch of the friends that are doing all that kind of stuff get to actually see one another in person.
Yeah. And I mean, that's kind of what our parties formed out of, was like, we would all be at the Emerald Cup. We'd all be like headed there anyways. And we would try to like make time for each other during the day when we're doing these transactions, but we would get so bogged down, especially in the later years, that we didn't have time to even talk to each other. And we'd just be like, all right, next year I'll catch you, you know, whatever. But so at the end, we were just like, fuck it. We're just gonna have to set aside a full night for partying after, where we can all hang out away from everyone and just chill. And I, you know, like it just naturally evolves sometimes that way. And it's really fun. You know?
It was kind of like one of those old harvest parties of old.
Yeah.
You know, where a bunch of people bring a lot of nice weed and they set it on the table and it's a bunch of chatting and eating and smoking and hanging out. And, you know, there's cool parts about that. obviously, like with the Emerald Cup and the High Times and a lot of the stuff that started happening on the West Coast, it became again like it was in the beginning with the High Times festivals in Amsterdam. It became again like a prestige, money-making, important thing.
Yes. Yeah, very
And
much so.
people would put a lot of effort into winning because they wanted to advertise that they had won, you know?
Yeah.
And all this shadiness came in. Like they'll remain nameless, but there was some clubs that would just hold back the nicest weed and hash they bought all year
Yeah.
and then enter it under their own label.
Yeah, of course. I mean,
You know?
that's a move. Like, how are you going to prove it wasn't grown by
But then
man?
you walk into their thing and they've got all these medals of all the shit that they've won. Look at all the good weed that's been in our store.
Look at this. Yeah,
we've got all these different medals, you know? And you know, hash makers winning a bunch of medals, flower makers. It's like it's free hardware. It like makes you maybe it makes it easier to sell in dispensaries. Maybe it gets people asking about your seeds, maybe at this and that. And so as a result of that, it went from, you know, harvest festivals that like they're totally non-economic way or just a way of for a bunch of weed nerds to conduct business, make friends, and exchange.
Yeah.
But then there's also this commerce aspect where it's like winning is a big deal.
Yeah.
You know, and so that's where some bullshit comes in, and that's where room and you know, weed people aren't the most like, you know, there's plenty of non-ethics that goes into something that's like unregulated. And so there's lots of rumors about how real or how not certain cups have been over time.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, that's
Right?
going to happen.
You know, people that win want to tout their shit. People that don't win want to be like it was fucking rigged. This person's friends or family or related
Yep.
or this is happening or da 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 or they paid for it or there was money exchanged or you don't know how it works. And you know, there's probably some fire there with the smoke. There's no point in talking about individual aspects, but there were so many of them and there was so much money at stake. It seems silly to think that there wasn't some, you know, it wasn't just purely altruistic, double blind studies dispassionately deciding which weed is best.
Absolutely. Yeah. Definitely not double-blind at any of these events. Even when you try, and I told you about this earlier. I won't say which event it was, but there was an event me and another person spent making. It was originally going to be called the Breeders' Cup, and we were just going to invite breeders. And the idea was breeders had to enter in their own weed that they grew, but it was still there's still an honor principle involved with that, right? Like they just had to present it, you know. That idea was expanded on and taken for another cup. And I went to that event and it seemed cool and everything, you know, everybody was chilling. And there was one thing nobody accounted for with all these rules that we thought we had accounted for everything. Someone brought a green jar that was green glass and clear. And anytime that jar was going around to the different tables, they always knew where it was. And it was supposed to be double blind, so nobody knew whose weed was which, right? Like
Right,
supposedly when it
except for nobody
and you're
had a green jar.
exactly. And when it came by your when your own weed came by and you knew it was your own weed, you had the honor system saying, hey, this is mine, I'm not gonna vote on it. However, suppliers of green jars voted on green jar, you know, it was a lot of shit like that. So even when there's things you can't account for, and I don't think that they brought the green jar there just to like purposely do that, it just is something that organically happened. And it was like, wait a minute, we have an advantage here. We know which one's ours. And Green Jar won the cup.
I mean,
Absolutely won.
there was a lot of money to be made in that era. I remember like the whole like DNA Crockett partnership. There were certain years of Emerald Cup on Friday and Saturday where they would have like a four-way booth that
Yeah.
would just have a line spidering off it in every direction.
Yeah, it's
And
crazy.
everybody was after Tangi and double banana Tangi and this and that and everything else. And you know, but I mean it was like, you know, there was certain if you were a hot seed company leading into that show,
Yeah.
It could be a huge windfall.
I mean, for
Just
example, like with what you're saying right now, during those years that DNA and Crockett entered that stuff, I was laying out tons of Kaleo and Banana OG stuff. In fact, Banana OG was the basis for most of my breeding program during that time. And it didn't matter because I didn't have the prestige. I didn't have any of that. Like Crockett, nobody knew who the hell Crockett was before they popped up. Nobody. But the second DNA picked them up, to the top because it was in all the High Times magazines. And all of a sudden they were saying, well, we have this banana. Oh, it's in High Times. And it just flew. And you're not even kidding. Like, there were lines out. It had always been available ever since Oregon Kid had put it out. Someone was releasing banana OG something ever since that point. But it was as if it had never existed before the second it entered High Times and the hype had struck.
I also think to tie into like the marketing and the push aspect of things, I do think they were smart in the sense that they, in the 215 era, they grew some greenhouses of their work.
Yeah.
And then they got professional photographers to come in and just take absolutely gorgeous shots of their weed.
Yeah.
You know, and some of their weed was very photogenic, you know. And you couldn't tell who was going to get you high, obviously, or anything like that, but
like Instagram.
Yeah, they drove sales with a lot of ad copy. I mean, Instagram, you know, weed people weren't ready to be marketed to.
Yeah.
A lot of the popularity in weed used to happen organically and in small groups and spreading from there.
Yeah. We talk about this ad nauseum every episode,
but it's like, that's another example of it, right? Is that, you know, I mean, when I'll give another example, when Skittles was hard to get. Mm-hmm. And so the vast majority of people that was going to get after it could only get hybrids. You know, you take somebody that had it like Dying Breed Seeds at the time or something. Mm-hmm. And they would have a huge line for that first 2 days of Emerald Cup, all selling $300 to $500 packs.
Mostly 500 of reg seeds. Yep.
Out the door, just like, bam, crazy, because people were after it. So, like Matt mentioned, if you marketed your stuff the right way, a few of those events could take care of you for the whole year.
Yeah, definitely.
It was big business. And it became so much more than the winning of the cups was important for sort of bragging rights and a different way to market. But mm-hmm. the other part of it was just sort of this gray area seed swap. Every kind of act, all you had to do was buy a booth and have a few permits, mm-hmm. and you could do all kinds of crazy sales. Now you have to, since 2018, you have to be licensed. It has to be through dispos. It's far more regulated and controlled. But in the era that Matt is talking about fondly, it literally was sort of like a weed swap meet.
Open air cowboy market. It was fun
sharing, you know, here's a joint, here's a dab, talk about this. Oh, I've got eight different jars of my different strains. You want to smell the line I'm selling?
Here's, I can grab the people moms by their fucking jacket and drag them across the floor. Nobody gives a shit.
Yeah.
Wild West.
Matt and I actually used to joke that we could have charity boxing matches at Emerald Cup where everyone could settle all their beefs or make up. You know,
yeah.
Oh, you just disappeared.
Can you hear me still?
I can hear you. Okay, your picture went kaput.
Yeah, I don't know why.
It went kaput. So
the right camera selected. Blah blah blah. Let me see what's going on. That's all right. Go ahead and keep going.
But yeah. Anyway, so Emerald Cup and some of those High Times, especially in Southern California for crews down there, it became a place to regularly see other people. It became a place where growers and seed makers and various industry people could meet up. Now it's like I'm split.
No, you're right. Good.
Anyway, in my opinion, a lot of people went and it was sort of totally irrelevant that there was a competition going on. They went to get seeds, or they went to meet certain people, or they went to see and be seen. Or just be able to walk around and see who was developing. There he's back.
There we go.
Booths, all kinds of stuff. And so there was a very cool, I would say, like raw capitalistic freedom to it.
Yeah. It was something special.
And that era is not here anymore. But also, you know, what else is interesting is we could bring something up that I find kind of cool is that the first cups, when we first started getting like real testing, mm-hmm. imperfect as it may be, I remember there was only four or five strains that tested in the high 20s.
Okay.
Right? Like literally, it was like there was a couple examples of Chem 91. There was a Strawberry Cough.
There was a Sensi Star.
Sensi Star and a Headband. And that was basically it.
Yep.
Right? For the first 5 or 6 years that there was testing with cups.
Yeah.
And then we started to see test creep, where all these numbers and all these terpenes and all these THC percentages started climbing. And we used to joke that, you know, there was one or two things in the 30% club.
Yeah.
And then fast forward 5 years and there's dozens of things in the 30% club.
Yeah.
And, you know, and people started breeding by numbers because they wanted to show high numbers in the dispensary and they wanted to show high numbers in the competition.
Yeah, I watched someone claim 50% the other day on the reg. So it's still happening.
I mean, I would even say, I don't know about people listening or whatever, but for my, strangely for me, I would say that the not all of it, but the vast majority of my favorite weed tends to come in between 18 and 25%.
Yeah.
Same. I don't know why. There's some exceptions, but it a lot of it falls in that range. Yeah. And I find a lot of the 30% club to have boring and not very long lasting highs.
Yeah.
You know, despite maybe they're potent in the sense, or maybe they wash well, you know, and they yield well, but I don't find that I don't think that all these 30%ers plus are revolutionizing cannabis and making these older, lower, weaker things irrelevant.
It just reminds me of the old article from 1982. And I want to say it was R. The Connoisseur, who I think is someone, I'm not going to say who, because he's never publicly said who he is. But he was referring to, in 1982, to ban the indica. He felt that the indica was going to ruin cannabis and that it was going to dumb down good weed. And indica, Afghanis, Pakistanis tend to be what shot that percentage spike up. So, I mean, maybe they were just Nostradamus, you know?
Well, I think it's interesting. We've chatted about that before too, but
yeah.
Most of the sativas they were smoking were bred for smoking flower.
Yeah.
And indicas were bred for harvesting resin.
Hashish.
And yes, you know, sir. and the two things are very different, you know. They didn't care about burnability with you know, Afghani or Pakistani. They didn't care about they cared about the hash.
Yeah.
The flower was just a carrier. And so I think a lot of that stuff got worked into weed due to, you know, police pressure.
Yeah. Flowering times, indoors.
And it does seem there was a lot of 70s and early 80s heads that did not like the effects that the indicas were bringing to the game.
Yeah.
They appreciated the earlier flowering times and the chunkiness and the frostiness. But as far as the point of smoking weed, how they enjoyed smoking it in joints.
Yeah.
A lot of them felt like it was kind of inferior.
I think a lot of those dudes, like nowadays, smoking a thing like cookies would just be that, you know, if you took that to them in that time and brought it to them, they'd be like, what the told you motherfuckers, you know? I really do think they would think that, because now we have a heavily inbred Kush style plant that is, you know, very, very narrow in the type of high, in my opinion, that it gives.
Yeah. I mean, everybody responds a bit differently, but you know, people know that I don't reach for cookie jars too often as far as like my go-tos, far as what affects me pretty well. But I also say that, you know, I grew up, and I'm not that young anymore. I grew up in an era where like the pure sativa era was long gone.
Yeah.
We were well into the mixed hybrids era. There's a lot of tempting things about Afghan.
Yeah.
It's you're trying to keep, you know, a lot of times, a lot of those early breeders like Neville and stuff, they were trying to add the structure and the frost and the density from the Afghan, but keep the flavor and the effect from the sativa. And in fact, that's why a bunch of their Afghan breeding material was bland and low terps and boring.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. That's what it sounds like you wanted. Yeah.
They picked intentionally low terpene plants to breed with sometimes.
Yeah.
When they wanted the terpenes and the flavors to shine from the other side of the hybrid through.
Yeah.
Right? So it was like a strategy.
Yeah, that's what it sounded like. I don't want to expand on it yet. I'll let someone else expand on it when we do that interview at some later date.
But yeah, I mean, one thing that's very cool is that We've done whole shows on specific breeders, mostly because in the era that they came out, there was so few of them. A lot of them dominated the game.
Yeah.
And even in the era we just talked about with the cups, there was really not that many people in competition with one another.
No, not really when it came to who was breeding the actual stuff that was supposedly winning these cups.
Yeah, you know, it's like that era of the NBA or whatever, where it's like there was like, you know, 12 teams.
Yeah.
Or something, you know, where like there wasn't that much competition amongst each other, but the competition was more concentrated. And yeah. Then the American cups really made it a democracy.
Yeah.
I don't think most people, you know, Matt, CSI, you know, Shaw, you know, you could Swamp Boys, you go through a whole list of people that like, a lot of people got introduced to their stuff by walking past their fucking booth.
Yeah.
Excuse my French, but just, you know, there's a banner.
Yeah.
You're pushing through the crowd and then, oh, there's Matt Riot.
Yeah.
You know, oh, that blueberry thing looks pretty.
Yeah, they usually didn't see me. I'm kind of small, so I'm usually tucked in behind.
They just and look like behind the
sharing
counter
a booth
down.
Of 20 people, and I'd be down in there somewhere.
There's Matt waving up from underneath the
three apples high, giving him a wave.
Matt's actually standing. That seat is just it's a fake back.
Yeah, it is a fake back seat. I'm standing. It's just...
but yeah, I mean it was. You know, a lot of times I wouldn't even want to bug my friends who had booths because people would wait all year to go talk to Caleb.
Yeah.
You know, they had a whole list of things that they wanted from him and they wanted to ask him questions and like whittle it down.
Yeah.
Same with you. Same with, you know, there was a lot of, you could buy a booth and, oh, you sell seeds, you sell hash, you sell tincture, you sell extract, you sell, you know, lozenges or edibles or any like shit like that, you could go meet a bunch of customers and make some loot.
Yeah. I mean, my favorite Emerald Cup story, and I've told this to a bunch of people and you'll probably get a kick out of it. You probably heard it a million times, but I was at Emerald Cup and this guy had emailed me beforehand and I didn't really know him too well, but we had talked back and forth through the email and asked me to put aside some Clockwork Orange seeds for him and a few other things, but mostly that. And he came up to my booth and he handed me this notepad and said it had written on it, "Hi, I'm, you know, whoever it was. And I, you know, this is what I came to get, you know," and I realized, oh, he's deaf and mute or something, like, oh, okay. And I, you know, wrote down what he got, and, you know, did the exchange. He's like, "Do I get a discount?" And I'm like, "Oh yeah, yeah, of course. Like, yeah, so here's a discount." And so he walks away and he comes back, or no, before he walks away, he goes, "Thank you," and walks off. And I'm like, this fucking guy, what the hell just happened? And then he comes back and he asked me, "So do you want me to put the discount in the fire fund or do you want it back?" So I was like, I put it in the fire fund. That ended up being Denali. That's how I met Denali.
Really?
And, so I never forgot from that experience out of meeting. And those days, like, you would meet thousands of people and it was really hard to have a memory, but that was like one of those ones that stood out because someone did something fucking crazy.
Yeah. I mean, it was a big thing. It was cool in that. I like that kind of like disorganized chaos capitalism.
Yeah.
You know, I think sadly, legalization has stripped a lot of that, like, organic. There's a lot of people that can't have a booth there anymore.
I won't even attend it anymore. And not, I don't say that other people shouldn't. I don't have a purpose for going anymore now. I'm not involved in the same community those people are involved in. They're going to that with their licenses and that kind of shit. So I just don't have the interest.
So obviously they're right there. It's split the weed community.
Yeah,
a lot of the people that you would want to go and see, you know, people would use IG and other things and they would find out, oh, Matt or Caleb or this person, they're going to this event. They're going to be at Emerald Cup. They're going to be at this High Times.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to plan and go see them.
Yeah.
You know, and people would come with specific plans, especially Emerald Cup, because it was in December. And back then people usually had harvest money burning in their pocket. And it was an era where a lot of people grew seed outdoor because they wanted individual good sized plants. you know, that drove a lot of sales too.
Yeah, that was a major aspect of it.
There was a lot of 25 to 50 plant victory gardens. Yeah. That they wanted to grow from seed because it was generally accepted you could get a bigger and more vigorous plant from seed than clone. Yeah. So if you were doing a limited number of plants growing from seed, you could probably get more off that 25 than you could if it was a clone plant.
Yeah.
If you picked the right strains and you went in the right direction.
That was the other cool thing about Emerald Cup was that it was a good time to get a lot of different samples of different things I had released that past year from different growers that year who had grown it, and they'd bring me samples. So I'd go home with shitloads of samples of my different strains grown in all these different environments. So there was just so much unique to that time. And I don't know with legalization if there's ever going to be a time where everybody can enjoy that unless they're, you know, multimillionaires can afford licenses and all the other stuff. I just don't know if that'll happen again.
You know, there's an old Grateful Dead saying, like, don't be sad it's gone, be glad you were there. And because, you know, when we were talking about all these first cups in the 90s and stuff, like having that kind of open swap meet where thousands of potheads and growers and seed makers and hash makers and all that could mix and mingle and talk about their craft was unthinkable back then.
Yeah.
You know, it was really unthinkable back then. I mean, I mentioned it before. There are definitely people that believe that there was a lot of DEA and other agencies scoping at a lot of those first cups.
I believe it. And I was just thinking now, I don't know if you could do it again, even if you like found a way to run a black market one with all the frickin' snitches in our scene. Like, they're just so abundant. Our scene doesn't police itself for that anymore. It's just a too different of a time to pull it off. I really don't think it'll work.
I think you could talk probably about like certain eras of music or this or that or whatever, where there's certain things that develop organically and they're only there while that persists. And then when you lose it, it shifts and it's not the same as it was.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, I think in addition to, you know, cups became really a way for, because by the time that a lot of these big cups were happening again, people were willing to show their faces and show up. People were willing to associate themselves with, I grew this and I have this and I'm bringing pounds of weed.
Yeah.
And I'm going to keep it in my booth and I'm not going to be arrested.
Yeah.
I remember even being sketched one of the first times when Tim first moved it, because I used to go to it up in Mendo when it was thrown up there and it was much smaller. And I remember I got there on a Saturday, the first year it was in Santa Rosa.
Yeah.
And I was walking up to the front door and there was this dude that was like all waddling past me and he was all fucking happy as happy as can be. And he had like a box full of plants that, you know, and it's like, they're just sticking out the top and he's like walking to his car. And I had this moment of like, you know, of just having been so secret for so long. I was like, man, things are really changing.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and then you walk in, right? And all of a sudden, you're like, especially from someone who grew up in an era where like plant counts were very important, right? And, you know, 100 could be a 5-year mandatory minimum federal sentence and this and that. Then you walk into these things and there was an era where there was clone sellers that had like 8,000 cuttings for sale.
Yeah.
Just racks.
Racks of them.
Racks of rooted cuttings. And you were like, whoa.
There, you know what? I remember one year I was at a booth with a nursery and I was selling seeds, but everybody thought that the clones behind me were my stuff. And I remember that caused so much chaos because everybody's like, yeah, can I get a clone of that and that? It's yours, right? It's on this list. Oh my God.
That comment you pinned, you know, in Chicago, when I lived in Chicago, I used to make friends that had a totally clean lifestyle drive me to the grow store.
Yeah.
Because of their license plate. You know?
Yeah. I knew a dude who would wear fucking wigs and all kinds of costumes on the way to the grocery store. And it wasn't switch a few cars.
It wasn't like boxes of clones was anything weird or we hadn't been doing that among our friends for a while. It was just like you were walking down the sidewalk in Santa Rosa.
It's a big fairground for people that don't know. It's a massive fairground.
You're just like out there, like right in the open in the most open sidewalk and everything. It's like, you know, tons of, and there's, and like, you're just walking all happily down the street with a bunch of rooted plants. And I was like, oh, weird.
Yeah.
You know,
weird. Yeah. You don't expect that.
Okay. And then you go in there and you're like, man, people have tons of dabs, tons of jars, tons of clones, all kinds of stuff that if it was like in your car and you got pulled over, would might be a mess.
Yeah. I see,
Even if you were fully like medical and legitimate and went to clubs and all that type of it would still be a mess. But it was like an accepted gray area, like you were on base.
yeah.
Right?
Depending on where you live, like I see dudes come to my city and like they'll be smoking a joint on the street like it's nothing because they think it's California and you're cool. And this is just, there's still hot places in California where if you do that, you're gonna get nailed so fast and they don't give a fuck if you have a license or any of that. They're gonna let you go to court and figure it out. So yeah,
But you
it's
know that I it was it is cool in the sense that there was like an equilibrium at that
yeah.
time. So anytime you could feel free and open and safe in our community is a blessing
Yeah, that's for sure.
because it wasn't like that for a long time. And so I think I would say that the Emerald Cup itself probably turned into part business, part economic, part award, and then a big family gathering
Yeah.
where all these people would come in from all over the place, from Colorado, from Washington, from Humboldt, from Mendo, from the Bay, from LA, and mingle,
Yeah.
and all that. And, cannabis has not really been able to have conventions.
No. Well, I mean, not at that point, no.
No, so it sort of doubled it. It sort of like did all these different duties.
Yeah.
And then it changed too, because most of the time the shit that was winning, it wasn't even that easy to go out and get those and figure out. Like it wasn't the same like it was from Greenhouse.
No.
It was like, oh, this person won with Sugar-E from some spot in Laytonville.
Yeah.
I don't know how to get that weed.
Yeah, a lot of the times it was like that early on. It I think over time it did turn into more of only things winning that you could buy seeds of because that is where the money came, was directed. It definitely got more like that at the end of the cups.
Yeah, I mean everything that's wild and free and unregulated eventually loses some of the wildness and they start acting rationally in terms of money and it morphs into different things. And then it becomes what the regulations and the rules allow.
Yeah.
Now it's sort of like a cooler it's like an industry meet.
Yeah.
Much more so than like a gathering, like a bunch of important people don't even go anymore.
To me, I think it's more like an MJ BizCon, and I don't see a lot of difference. Like, I mean, maybe they still do awards. I think they have a separate awards event
They moved
now.
it to LA too, which is even
Yeah.
funnier because one of the things that was cool about Emerald Cup was that it started in Mendo. So it was done by people from the Triangle
Yeah.
and old growers from the Triangle. And it was a big family gathering. And then even when it moved to Santa Rosa, it was still NorCal.
Yeah.
Sonoma County is very much still, the very southern tip of that bubble.
Yeah.
But once it's in LA and it's in a theater and it's awards, I mean, I get it. They're moving with the industry trends. It's not going to be what it was.
So is
They're not.
this Emerald Cup that everybody's talking about going to going to be in LA or Santa Rosa?
It's now.
Is it going right now? This
Now,
weekend?
right now. Yeah, right now.
Where?
This
In
weekend.
LA?
In Santa Rosa.
Oh, okay, that's why I didn't
They
go.
call
Set
it,
up.
they call it, I believe it's like they call it the Emerald Ball now.
I got some fucking emerald balls for him.
And then I do believe they have like a separate ceremony in
Yeah.
LA.
Yeah.
But it got a little convoluted with COVID for a few years there and
Yeah.
not being able to have those kind of events. And then they did a separate event in LA last year. So I don't know exactly how they're going to shake it all out.
Yeah.
But for a minute, it seemed like they were going to abandon NorCal for LA, which was going to be kind of shitty. But it does appear that they're still throwing a party up there.
How weird is it, and I'll leave names out, that the owner of Emerald Cup was giving awards to his daughter's soon-to-be husband and smashing all the cups with it? Was that ever heavily debated or talked about?
I mean, there's not, as we talked about in the beginning, we were trying to avoid specific instances because,
Sure.
you don't want to battle over certain ground. But certainly, whenever there's money and prestige, right? And all that stuff on the line, reputation on the line, economics on the line, That's why people debate whether how legitimate any cup could be. Sure. And then there's people that get a little bit of inside information and decide that seems kind of sketchy. Mm-hmm. In lots of awards, family members and close friends can't participate.
Yeah.
But that's not true of cannabis awards.
Apparently not.
It is definitely not
for some. Yeah.
You know, and there's nepotistic things that occur, certainly, and there's friendships and there's beefs and there's in crowds and out crowds in weed, and I don't even know how blind some of the blind stuff is.
Yeah.
And then even if it is blind, you have a group of people and it's just their expression of prejudices.
Yeah, and even with all that, you're it's still the honor system saying this is this strain I'm presenting you.
I mean, I'm pretty sure I'm not going to get into specifics, but I'm pretty sure there was at times some weed that was winning quite a bit that was not very pretty.
Mm-hmm.
That was entered into the sun-grown categories and stuff like that was grown underneath multiple nice indoor lighting.
Like supplemental indoor lighting?
Yeah, like you have a little section that you're growing your stuff you're going to enter. And it's in the greenhouse and it's got the sun hitting it, but it's also got ceramics and some LEDs and some this and some that, and it gets extra special sauce. And yeah, it's sun grown. And then it comes out looking like crazy and all of a sudden it's winning. And, you know, because we come from a culture that bends or ignores rules.
Yeah. I mean, people will do anything to win.
Yeah. Anything. Especially when maybe if you win, you know, that next year, you find it way easier to move a lot of your product for higher pricing in dispensaries then.
Sure.
And then that next year, because you won and all your stuff was in dispensaries and a bunch of people smoked it, you have a crazy line out your booth for your hybrids.
Yep.
So there was multiple arcs like that where people won and then the economic interest was great for them for 2 or 3 years after that. There was reverberations.
Mm-hmm.
So of course there's going to be that kind of stuff.
Always,
you know, that's just,
I just don't think people know, you know, that's the thing. Like there's always the announcements. There's always, you know, like stuff that's surface level. And then there's the stuff that like people behind the scenes know. And then there's stuff that people in certain groups that, you know, are family friends of certain people. And they're like, how did that fly? I guess, you know, it just does. And it's not just one specific cup. It's a lot of them. It's all of them. And like I said, even with the one that I helped organize and I helped plan the rules for, there were things that we couldn't even possibly conceive of. A green jar. Like, we really thought we had it all nailed out, but there's always ways.
Yeah. We've had friends that have judged various things and they've seen things that they didn't think were the greatest,
mm-hmm.
you know, behind the scenes. And you know, there's a lot of pressure now. I think a lot of those cups, they were making so much money renting out expensive small amounts of booth space to all of you guys.
Yeah.
That just throwing them was highly profitable for them.
They were making millions off just the booth space. Something, you know, ridiculous. Yeah.
So, you know, there was that. There was a desire to throw more and more and more of them, right? Yeah. And now with all the rules and regulations and all that other types of stuff, it's taken a lot of the soul out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also just the competition of people that can afford licenses.
Yeah. And there's one more thing I want to talk about before is judging. And, you know, I talked about it briefly in the Gonjir part, you know, when they were talking about how they select their judges or whatnot. I noticed that a lot of times at even some of these prestigious events, judging isn't necessarily based on the most skilled people in the room at assessing cannabis. In fact, most often that is not the case when it comes to judging. A lot of times it's people paying. They pay for their judges pass, or they pay for their judges kit where they get all kinds of extracts or buds. And it's very hard for me to understand someone that is new to cannabis being able to have a qualified nose, any of it, really. I mean, what are you basing your whole
thing on? It's another aspect too, where it's like it might be just a collection of industry people and people associated with the people throwing the event.
Yeah.
You know, and in some cases you're like, oh, here's a random assortment of different kinds of stoners. It's fair.
The fact that you can buy your way in, though, blows my mind. Blows my mind. And that's for a lot of these big extracts cups, too. Like, just buy your way into Judge. So I'm going to put something in and let some random ass kid that may have smoked twice in his life judge. It doesn't make any sense.
That's the thing. It's like, it's totally unregulated and there's no penalties and there's no outside body governing any of it.
Yeah.
So it's all the honor system. And like you said, I mean, that's part of the reason why we do these shows is like, because there's a bunch of stuff we talk about all the time that isn't well known.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people, part of the reason why the cups thing works so well is because for a lot of smokers, they're just like, oh my God, that must be some of the best shit out there.
Yeah.
And they don't have the nuance to it, you know?
Yeah. They don't know the context. Yeah, exactly.
They don't have the context. They don't know the characters involved personally or whatever, you know? And it's not to say that like it's all corrupt or whatever all the time. It's just people have their belief systems and they're influenced by what they like and what they don't like. It's like in food, like anything that doesn't have a legal definition, like natural.
Yeah.
It doesn't actually have a real meaning. It's an advertising meaning.
Yeah. So, we went over that one.
Yeah. So cannabis judging right now is absolutely subjective.
Yeah, very much so. And like I said, to the point of where calling it judging may be a little stretch way of putting it.
The other part of it is, let's say that you're totally advanced and that you are a titan in your field and all kinds of people respect you, you know, and, you know, let's just, you know, and you're in the hash game or whatever, and everybody loves the hash you make and you're really good at it and you have a fine nose for it. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And you're definitely one of the people that could be judging.
Sure.
And then you're smoking 20 dabs in 2 hours.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, the effect of each individual dab and like what it does to you and how it makes you feel, or even if you're smoking 20 joints in the course of a few hours of different weed and you're layering all those effects and highs on top of each other, it's not like you're waking up in the morning, smoking a joint of this, going about your business and really getting a sense for what that one thing does.
Yeah.
No. You know, so unless there are some places that give you samples ahead of time and have you take a bunch of notes. But there's also like, just back to back.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And then how well can you judge? Typically when I smoke 10 or 15 kinds of weed that I don't smoke on a daily basis, I get ripped.
Yeah.
It just adds up.
Eventually. Yeah. Yeah. It's just what happens.
You know, I smoke a bunch of my friend's weed, you know, and it's weed that I don't smoke very often, and it's all rapid fire, and I'm just hit joint after joint after joint.
Yeah.
You know, I might not be the best judge that day.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if you don't like the way that I matched my my clothing to this lovely chair behind me.
I think it's pretty good. You did a good job matching it. You kind of
I went through, you know, there was a huge debate in my prep team.
All the designers that you have sponsoring you. I know it's a big wide choice in your wardrobe.
It's all what it really does is it accents all my face makeup, you know, and that gives me that natural tone that I'm after.
Yeah, it's good. It's working well for you, son.
So
we're at 1 hour, 23 minutes. We'll probably cut this one a little bit short, but I wanted to, let everybody know we're going to be doing the show at a different time now. I mentioned it briefly on Instagram. We're going to start doing the shows on Saturdays after this show. This is the last one on Fridays. We're going to start doing it Saturdays at 1 p.m. Pacific Standard or whatever time. Pacific. 1 p.m. Pacific.
Pacific time. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's where the show is going to be moving to. We were kind of looking at where everyone, like YouTube, gives you those like statistics. And that seems to be where everybody's watching at a good time. And we've noticed that people say like they prefer to watch it on Saturdays in their grow room. And I know this is late for the East Coast, and especially for some of our across the country people. And Knox is back and forth across the country all the time now. And he's getting old. He's getting a little old in his age.
Tired.
So we worry about him. We worry about him staying up too late. So, yeah. Is there anything else you wanted to get in on this topic?
I mean, I think you could just simply say that, you know, cups are a little bit of humanity. You know, there's community, there's meeting with people of similar interests. Yeah. There's bringing different groups together that might not have been friends or have met before. There was a lot of positives to the different eras of the cups.
Yeah.
And then obviously, but you get rep and you get money and you get economics involved, and then you get all the shadiness and the backhanded deals and like the how can I lock in money for me? And those kind of things go hand in hand. So when you hear us talking about all of the ways that we fall short on a perfectly ideal cup, it doesn't mean that there's not value to going and seeing yeah. folks and doing all that type of thing. It just changes, you know, people's reasons for going change.
Yeah.
You know,
and over the years, they've the whole existence and reason for them existing have changed.
Yeah. And I mean, I think some, because they've happened for long enough now, some mm-hmm. of the excitement of just being able to go and meet a bunch of people and put faces to names.
Yeah.
You know, that might just be an internet handle or might yeah. just be a someone you knew from IG or whatever, but then you get to spend a few hours with them and break bread or whatever. Cause you met at the cup and get baked and exchange some cool shit.
Yeah.
That was a neat aspect for a while. It's become yeah. more common now, so it's not as exciting. But in the beginning, it felt pretty special for a good long time.
It did. And you got to meet some of the most amazing people that you could meet in the industry at one point.
So for all those reasons, I have mostly positive memories of it.
Yeah.
I will say something funny though, and this yeah. isn't going to knock anybody, but I remember going to the cup and I thought to myself, especially when it was in Santa Rosa, I'm like, we are the worst dressed group of people. There is this dude, and he looks like he went to go transplant, you know, in his Carhartts in his ripped shirt that day, and then sweated and then rolled down the dirt hill and then drove to the cup.
Yeah.
But in his hand, he's got like a $15,000 dab rig.
Yeah, right.
Right. And a really nice fanny pack, you know? And so you yeah. think, oh, that person looks homeless, except for they're carrying around this like foot tall piece of glass that's like worth a small car.
Yeah, worth more than my life.
Right? You know, and so there was just people that like, you know, what you put your money, there was like well-dressed, snazzy people there with nice watches and this and that. There were straight hill hippies with zero ink, like I don't even have clean clothes.
Yeah.
But I have all this cool weed shit, you know, and I don't care. And so it brought together very disparate groups of weed people.
Yeah, and watch out for that dude walking around pretending to be deaf and dumb too. Watch out for him. He's a motherfucker.
Yeah. Yeah, he's a tricky old man.
Perfect script from up north, or cut upon it.
All right. So anything else, dude? Wanna lay
No,
out?
I mean just that we're gonna move to the afternoon on Saturday, like Matt said. We hope it's mm-hmm. a better time for everybody. You know, it might be easier to give us that than your Friday night. Especially for people on the East Coast. So
people's lives in general.
Yeah, I don't know what that is. But and you know, everyone's at the Emerald Cup this weekend probably, so enjoy yourselves. Have a good week, everyone.
Yep. Cheers.
That's gone kunk. What? Where else? Burp, skirp, skirp, burp, burp, burp. Get some cheese. Dude, I'm sorry, dude. I'm tripping.